Well, I guess why don't you start with kind of explaining what it is that why this lake was a good choice as a not one that's generally accessible to the public.
Sure.
For the experiment that you guys are running.
Yeah. For the experiment that we're running here, which is overall the objective is, does adding trees or coarse woody habitat to a lake increase fish community productivity or the carrying capacity of the lake? And, you know, there's not, even though there's thousands of lakes up here, there's not a lot of lakes where we can do a manipulation or experiment at that sort of scale. Also in the absence, you know, as we look around the lake today, there's no development. This is the minor footprint of any development on the lake in its entirety. So we can truly understand how the fish community responds to that manipulation in the absence of things like high fishing pressure, invasive species, lakeshore residential development, excess nutrient loading, all those things. So it was really ideal. It was ideal because it's a manageable lake size. It's about 90 acres, this lake here. In addition to that, we've really only studied kind of woody habitat dynamics in relatively simple fish communities, largemouth bass and yellow perch, or largemouth bass and bluegill. This lake has a pretty species diverse fish community for a small lake. So we've got naturally reproducing muskellunge, smallmouth bass, walleye, largemouth bass, as far as the panfish, yellow perch, rock bass, bluegill, pumpkin seed, green sunfish, and hybrids of those species. There's some white sucker in here. There's very few crappie. So it's a very diverse fish community. We can understand a little bit more than just bass and bluegill and bass and yellow perch about how the fish community or a more diverse fish community might respond to these sorts of manipulations.
So why don't you take us around and show us some good examples of what you've been able to do?
Sure. So we started the experiment out here in 2015, and often when we do, or generally always with whole lake experiments, what we should be doing is we should have a treatment and a reference system. So our reference system for this lake is Escanaba Lake. And in 2015 to 2018, we essentially came out here every spring and sampled the fish community and got to understand the limnological conditions, the riparian zone conditions. So for 3 years, we just wanted to get a baseline. How was this lake behaving, so to speak? Is its fish community, is its water quality, and other aspects that we were interested in that might be influenced by a whole lake addition of woody habitat. And in 2018, in the summer of 2018, these are some of the trees that were dropped at that point. So you can see the needles are no longer on the trees anymore, but they're still maintaining a pretty high branching complexity even after 7 years of being in this lake, ice conditions. But the bark is starting to be gone now. But again, those very smallest branches seem to be holding on. The needles are gone. It's early in the season yet. If this was about a month from now, you'd see periphyton or algae growth on these trees that we dropped in 2018. If we get up close, maybe not right now, but in the summertime, you'll see small bluegills and other fish that are all inside that refuge area. You might see some of the larger predatory or piscivorous fish-eating fish, musky bass, using the outside edges of them. In a couple weeks here, we might see like smallmouth bass and largemouth bass nesting in association with that wood. So this was the initial phase of the experiment, or phase one, where we dropped 140 trees all along the north shore of the lake here. And we did it in kind of bundles and complexes. As you can see, we got a couple there, and we're just kind of opportunistic with the sizes. And we dropped trees commensurate with what the forest is. It was about 87% conifers, 13% deciduous trees, mostly maples. So that was the first phase of the project, and then we monitor it. You know, what happened to the fish community? What happened to the limnology of the lake in that first 5, 6, 7 years? Actually, we monitored for 6 years is what it ended up being, because we missed a year with COVID with field restrictions.
Spike nets, or is that more electroshock?
So both. So when we sample the fish community, we do surveys out here just like we do on a lot of our other lakes. We'll spike net it for usually out here for about a month to get through all the species. We get mark recapture population estimates on all the major species in here. And then through the collection of aging material from those fish and the population estimates, we can measure production, so fish production of the fish community. And production is a rate, so it's, for scientific terms, it's kilograms per hectare per year. English units would be pounds per acre per year. And so it's a rate of the productive capacity of an individual species. And what we found, we've just submitted this paper for publication to Fisheries Magazine, which is an American Fisheries Society publication, is that in 6 years post Coast Woody Habitat addition of those 140 trees, we've doubled the fish community production of Sanford Lake here. What mostly happened is what we hypothesized would happen is every one of these trees is setting up a micro ecosystem within this larger ecosystem. So that tree drops in, it slowly starts to degrade, that periphyte grows on it, that algae, that healthy algae. That attracts benthic macroinvertebrates, that attracts the small fishes that eat those, and eventually that's to translate up into the upper trophic levels, into the muskie, into the bass, and into the walleye. So in this phase of the experiment right now, most of that production is all locked up in those lower trophic level forage fishes. So major increases in production in yellow perch, bluegill, and rock bass as a response to the experiment. And we'll continue to monitor it as we get farther down the lake here. Phase two of the project was to drop trees on the entire western shoreline of the lake. And so we really loaded it up this last time and we'll see this when we get down the shore, we added 240 more trees to this lake in early November this past fall. And the reason we're doing this and staggering it is we want to find out, or we want to test whether there's a point where fish production basically caps out and saturates. So is there a point where, you know, you don't get the benefit of adding the wood anymore for fish production? You see some of the periphyte in there. That's also freshwater sponge, which is kind of neat. The other reason that we are staggering these tree drops in the lake, because eventually we'll have a third phase where we do the rest of the lake, the entire southern shore. We're staggering it because most of the lakes in northern Wisconsin or almost anywhere, there's not going to be this amount of area to put trees into. So it'd be good to know if there is a saturating point, and we get the question of how many trees should we add to get this sort of response, or what type of trees should we add to get a response. We should be able to answer some of those questions. So again, everything we're trying to do here is applied so that what we learn here can be taken out in the landscape for the greater good of lakes based on what we observe here.
Yeah, so if you determined if there's a difference between dropping a conifer versus a deciduous tree?
Not a difference per se. It's only going to be, or what we do know is it's going to be in longevity of how long that wood's going to last. And so everything we've dropped in here is either a hardwood or a conifer, and they last a long time compared to something like a birch or an aspen in our softer woods. They also maintain their branching complexity a bit better. But like the conifers, you know, if we were to take a chainsaw out of that one right there and we cut into that, that sap would smell as fresh as cutting that tree down in the wood. It doesn't degrade very rapidly at all, especially those that are underwater. So it's a long process. They've done some dendrology on woody habitat and lakes and some Ontario lakes, and some of those pieces of wood had been in the lake for 500, 550 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's very long lived. Another reason for doing the experiment out here though is that there was a lot of woody habitat in this lake, but it was all highly degraded and not contributing to the system, so to speak, anymore. And so this was kind of a pulse of new coarse woody habitat, new carbon that's going to slowly enter this system. And then, as we've shown so far, it's made its way into the food web and increased fish production.
So is there a difference between someone who will put logs out on the ice in the middle of the lake versus dropping a tree on the edge of the lake?
Yeah. So we've had a lot of conversations about that and some research. And so formerly within Wisconsin DNR, you know, we'd fill out permits for cribs, fish cribs, which is more of what you're talking about, Zach, where we're going to go out into some deeper water. It's not going to be a navigational hazard. We're going to kind of sink a log cabin or a complex of trees. We've gotten away from that as an agency. We still have that permit and we still allow it, but we've gone more towards fish sticks and tree drops, which this is, because that simulates the natural environment of what would happen. That pine tree right there, you know, when that dies, it has 360 degrees to fall, and about 180 of them would be associated with the lake. That's the natural process we're trying to simulate with this. What we did here was by request of the group that we're working with. They wanted us to specifically do tree drops. Another thing that we promote that's probably even better than tree drops is, if possible, go cut wood in an upland forest that's away from the lakes. You leave all the riparian habitat to fall in. Bring that onto the ice in the winter and distribute it like this. And that's what we call our fish sticks program that Scott Toschner started at least 10 years ago now in northwestern Wisconsin, based out of the Hayward and Brule area.
So I guess obviously there's an advantage to having a private lake that you can do this on, where it is more of a controlled experiment.
Yeah.
But if we're going to expand this to public lakes that are developed, they don't have trees left, but they can still possibly get there by fish sticks.
And that's exactly what we're doing. So, as an agency, we, prefer to have the riparian zone intact. There's all kinds of benefits to having that riparian forest, from nutrients, preventing nutrients from getting in the lake, water kind of purification, clarification sorts of purposes, so those runoff effects, but then also having that leaf litter that naturally falls in the lake, breaks down and gets incorporated into the food web, as well as just the woody habitat that might naturally fall in through a storm event or senescence or a beaver dropping it into the lake. So that's exactly what we'd promote in those sorts of situations, is that we want, we'd sign that permit, but we want you to bring it from upland sources, drag it onto the lake in winter, and distribute it.
And we were on Lake Namakagan,
mm-hmm,
with Mike DeAndrea,
and
he said they've dropped a number on one undeveloped section of shoreline. So how fast do they see results?
So I'd say relatively quickly, depending on what the response is. And so, in general, as soon as you drop these trees, they'll become fish attracting structure really rapidly, especially for the small fishes, and then the larger fishes will often set up ambush points on the edges of it. Then within a couple years, you're gonna start to see the degradation of the tree bark, the pine needles falling off and things like that. That's where you start to get your periphyton through that degradation and those release of nutrients. The macroinvertebrates quickly respond to that. And then, like I said, the microecosystem, now the fish progression starts. So it happens pretty rapidly, once these are implemented. Another question we get about this, I talk about periphyton, and it's kind of a healthy, naturally algae. One of the other questions that we answered in this experiment is, we'd heard a number of times, if we add trees to our lake, that's going to make the water less clear. It's going to, because of the nutrients that are in the system now, it's going to lead to harmful algal blooms, and it's just going to change our water quality in general, so we're not in favor of it. We just published a paper recently, said that basically what we did out here changed none of those variables. It didn't change anything meaningful. Chlorophyll A went up a tiny bit, but it didn't make any difference with second disc transparency or water clarity in this lake. And so that was, I think, a good, again, one of those demonstration experiments like I talked about. Until you do it and you measure it and you get it out there and are able to talk about it, people may be reluctant to do something that's quite beneficial for a lake.
There's a lot of conventional wisdom that you have to overcome in a lot of these places, where people, yeah, this is why we've always done it, this, yeah, is what we've always assumed. How hard is it to, can one study penetrate some of that? Or does it have to be a study that then shows it? They have to feel it themselves.
I think a little bit of both. I think the demonstration science helps a lot, but it is also the outreach then, right? And so as an agency, we spend a lot of time working with lake associations and anglers and fishing clubs to take the science that's out here that we're looking at right now, and the research we're looking at right now, and the results, and taking it out into the public and having those conversations and showing those things and talking about it. And so I think that's one of our greatest tools that we have for some of those transformative changes or policy changes. And then, like I said, I think oftentimes there's a lot of, it can be very contagious. And so you get a lake association or someone that sees the results, they understand the results, and then it becomes, they're promoting it, and it propagates from there. So I think a lot of that is where, big progress comes from these sorts of things. So you see all the freshwater sponge that's growing? So that's been a really...
That's the green stuff, yep, that's down there?
Yep. So this kind of green, wavy sort of stalks there, that's freshwater sponge. And that was a pretty big response. A lot of periphyton, but a lot of freshwater sponge on most of these trees.
Are we able to kind of go into them?
Yeah.
And Ethan's got the GoPro. We can kind of put that down the water.
I'm going to take you to one of our biggest ones down here. We got a huge hemlock that we dropped, and maybe that'll be a neat one. That one was so loud when it hit the water, it like cut out the audio on my video camera. It just like went blank for a second when it hit the water. And we've left a couple areas in here by the club's request, like this one, not to drop trees here. There is some walleye spawning that goes on in here. But for the most part, you know, we added a lot of trees, and we're going to go along the western shoreline here, which we did last fall. Take a look. Other work that we're doing out here, we're doing a lot of behavioral work with fish to see how they respond to this. So we have muskie, smallmouth, largemouth, and walleye that have radio transmitters in them. So we find where they are in the lake every 2 weeks. We've had what are called pit tag receivers out here. So your pit tag is the same as like a microchip that you might put into a pet if it gets lost and you can find it. We put a lot of those into fish, and we had receivers out here that were tracking fish movements in relation to the new habitat constantly, basically. Anytime they passed over those antenna, they would get picked up, and we get that information. A former master's student of mine worked on that aspect of the project out here.
And you found that they were coming into more?
It's been very interesting. So there was definitely some early attraction to the structure, but then we started to see more offshore movement and just movement in general. And we think, you know, based on the literature and those results, what we're seeing is that we probably created so much good refuge habitat in here that it didn't become good foraging habitat anymore. You can hit that point, and it's another reason of doing the experiment of how much is too much, where you start to imbalance things in the other way. Because we know this with aquatic weeds and with some woody habitat studies. Went up. And in other studies, we found that their activity cost for the predators went down because it would just stay in association with the habitat.
Mm-hmm. That's less.
It's been 7 years, and we can see, you know, if you look into the water, all the branching complexity that's still remaining in habitat that's creating for small fish. And I'll also note, you know, these woody habitat additions are not just for fish. You know, this is basking habitat for turtles. In the right situation, a loon may build its nest on a floating log in the right situation. You see blue herons perched on them and fishing. So there's a lot of different benefits. You know, yellow perch lay their eggs. Their egg ribbons will be draped across this coarse woody habitat. Same thing for frogs and toads and our amphibians. They use this habitat too.
Yeah, the number of tadpoles, massive tadpoles.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And that's not even many. In some years out here, we're dip netting out 5 gallon buckets full of tadpoles. And what I've understood over the years here, I'm pretty sure they're green frogs. And what happens is that they get these banner tadpole years where everything's right. And there's so many of them that it becomes a rhinovirus die off. So we've seen it on Escanaba for sure. And I think it's seen it here. So as they start to emerge from tadpoles to become frogs, right at that stage, that rhinovirus kind of hits and knocks those densities down. And so you'll see a lot of dead tadpoles and frog or tadpoles that are going through metamorphosis.
I didn't realize green frogs got that big.
Yeah, the tadpoles. Yeah, they get pretty good size. These tadpoles are in the water for at least 2 years, and so a lot of the ones in here in Escanaba, they're getting their legs right now. So we're just ending the first phase of the woody habitat addition right now. Again, that was in June of 2018 that we dropped those trees along the north shoreline. And then we started phase two this past fall, in early November of 2024, where now we're on the western shoreline of the lake. And I came out here with a forester and took a look opportunistically at what trees would make sense species-wise to drop in. And now we're seeing, you know, trees that have been dropped in wherever we're at 6 months ago now, and have just gone through their first winter. And you can see there's a little discoloration on some of the pine needles there, but we still have some green underneath. And again, we were pretty opportunistic at trying to put the trees in bundles, creating a lot of habitat to continue to see how it influences the fish community production of the lake and other aspects of the aquatic ecosystem out here. We worked with some amazing loggers that did this. How long do you think it took to drop 240 trees into the shoreline of the lake with two guys?
Walking?
Yep.
With a chainsaw?
Yep.
A week?
3 hours. We started about 9:30 and we were eating lunch at 1. And they took a couple breaks. It was a little bit warmer that day and I certainly understand it. I was like, guys, by all means, I'm like, take your time. And they didn't want to go back to the shop to grease equipment and stuff like that. And so, and it was, I mean, it's just amazing to watch a professional work in that aspect. I wish I had the same level of confidence.
Yeah,
so sure. Just, I'm like, guys, this is absolutely incredible what you're doing. This is amazing. And they're like,
you can see the beaver.
Mm-hmm. They're like, this is the cherry of cherry jobs we get. We're not trying to lift a huge tree that's sitting over somebody's garage. You know, with this lift, this pulley system, he's like, we're just dropping trees. He's like, this is great.
I figured it would take longer than just to walk.
He said 3 hours.
Wow.
And they probably took at least, they took like a 10 minute break and they took like a 20 minute break. And it's literally just zip, zip, boom. Zip, zip, boom.
So is the bike nut in here deliberately trying to see what comes into these shorelines?
It's more opportunistically. We typically set them in slightly different areas, but now that there's so much wood on this side of the lake, it's harder to get to the some of the places we wanted to. So Taylor, she's the one, Taylor and Dylan set it this year, so they just set it more opportunistically to get good coverage of the lake where we know there's decent walleye spawning habitat. Because our nets out here, they've got good coverage throughout the lake and we're getting all species, but at least early on, we're targeting walleye spawning habitat.
So what is the walleye per acre on this lake?
Out here, it started at about 3 adults per acre in 2015. Like many of the lakes up here, especially the smaller ones, we've seen that slightly decline over time. We've written about this. We can't say that it's because of the tree drops causing it, because it's been a system, like a systemic pattern up here at that same time, where small lakes and walleye recruitment seem to go down. We've seen an uptick of largemouth bass out here afterwards, but that's often what happens in other places. So our note to those interested in this practice for fish habitat purposes is probably to be precautionary in walleye lakes and certainly not on known walleye spawning locations within a lake. This lake probably did not originally have walleye. It was stocked by the club in the 70s. It was naturally reproducing. But again, as we talked about this morning, some of that fades away over time, where this lake is, it's got very limited walleye spawning habitat, very limited. Okay. And in fact, I can't even tell you exactly where they spawn in here. I could go on an Escanaba and point out 10 different areas where I know walleyes are going to be spawning if we went out there at night and electrofished it, or probably even more. In here, we've been out here electrofishing what we think is peak spawn, and you get a couple here, you get a couple there, but you don't see the concentrations of fish like we do in other lakes.
So what are the types of habitat that are ideal for walleye spawning?
So for walleye spawning, I mean, their ideal habitat is to have gravel and cobble.
Yeah.
And so and oftentimes like on windswept shorelines, so that it's constantly cleaning that silt, and it's nice and oxygenated. So when walleye spawn, they're broadcast spawners, which means that they spawn and then there's no parental guarding or anything. They just leave those eggs to the mercy of environmental conditions. But with that spawning habitat, those eggs are sticky. They fall down into the interstices of that gravel and cobble, where they're kind of protected. They've got enough oxygen. They're not getting suffocated by silt or detritus. And so that's what walleyes are really looking for.
So then why do they use the marshes on the wolf?
So there's unique circumstances where walleye can do some different things. There's, I think, Lake Pepin in the Mississippi River is a similar situation. And so somehow they're making it work and found a way to adapt to those marsh conditions in spawning in them. But in general, with walleye as a river fish, that's what they're seeking is gravel and cobble. And there's gravel and cobble in here, but it's a smaller lake. It's not, it doesn't get windswept just by the general nature of it being small. It's got the wind pushing us in a little bit.
Did you want to put the GoPro in
sure.
the water?
Yeah.
Especially under some of these green ones?
Yeah.
And if you need it, we've got a lot of B-roll of that stuff. Of GoPro, of underwater photography, from our comms gals. They came out here and got in the water for a couple days and did a bunch of it. And if you need anything specifically from me, Ethan, just let me know.
Yeah, sure.
Evaluating those regulations.
So that feels like another one that's going to have science and then the politics or the implications for, you know, the people that fish those the most heavily, not wanting to have to change what they've always done.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit half and half. I understand why we're doing it, and I'm glad we've done, you know, a very nice experiment testing it on over 100 waters for a period of time that will let us know how panfish are going to respond. I do worry a little bit because of some panfish and negative interactions with walleyes and other species, because that should serve to increase abundances too if you lower exploitation. But I guess that becomes part of the next experiment to see what happens.
Well, that's crappie, right?
More so. Yeah, crappie.
Perch abundance is good for walleye.
Right.
But crappie, do they predate on walleye more exclusively?
The crappie?
Yeah.
We think, and it's really difficult with diet studies like that because it can happen really, really quickly. You know, you've got a whole bunch of crappies and then the walleyes are all this big and they're interacting in the same habitat. They can disappear almost before you can even track it. But my inclination is that when walleye are, you know, being born, they're interacting with adult crappie that are feeding heavily at that time. And crappies are, they're piscivores. They will eat plankton and things like that, but if they can get minnows, that's gonna be a main forage for them. And I think it's just one of those things where they could probably wipe out a year class when they're at higher abundances pretty quick. Am I doing okay for you, Ethan? Okay.
So there really aren't gonna be any like good walleye crappie lakes.
In general, what we see is that they cycle, there's rehabilitation. So Kentuck Lake is a great example up here in Vilas County, where Kentuck Lake's walleye population has collapsed a number of times. Whenever it collapses, it usually turns into a world-class crappie fishery for a while. Okay. I don't think it mentioned it in Paul Romsky's Walleye Beautiful Creature of the Night book, but he was talking about the Upper Red Lakes. When that population collapsed in Upper Red, the walleye population, that was a world-class destination for crappies. And so they seem to go that way, where if crappie get the upper edge, walleye go down, or if walleye go down for some reason, it releases the crappies.
Yeah, I remember fishing Kentuck when I was a kid. That was just a crazy panfish lake, and then all of a sudden it shifted again.
Yep. So we have several examples of that where, you know, a walleye population collapses or declines and the crappie fishery just takes off.
So why are largemouth bass different than smallmouth bass then when it comes to interacting with walleye?
With walleye?
Yeah.
Smallmouth habitat preferences are much more specialized than largemouth bass, and largemouth bass tend to be a bit more of a generalist feeder. So smallmouth bass, you know, their spawning habitat, they're going to need to exclusively find some gravel and cobble. There might be sand over those areas, but they'll fan out a nest to get to that habitat. Whereas some of the largemouth bass work I've done, they can spawn on just about anything. You'll see them spawning on muck, you'll see them spawning on top of that log right there, you'll see them spawning on top of a rock, especially when they're at higher densities. So they kind of make it work. And I think where largemouth and crappie, they're very similar species as far as a bit more generalist in their spawning habitats, how much fish they eat. Like smallmouth, they eat a lot of crayfish if it's available. They'll also eat fish too, but they're typically associated with rocks and crayfish, benthic macroinvertebrates, where bass are just much more generalist predators, okay. Probably much like a crappie is. Should I just keep putting around? Or do you need something specific?
I think we're probably good on this end. We'll probably, if we head back
to... Get to in Madison.
I don't know.
I mean, if it was 82 here, yeah. I'm sure it was, I don't know if you'd be pushing 90, but I bet you it was pretty darn warm.
No, this feels like what I expected, like a nice day in spring to be.
This would be a nice spike net day outside of the... It's a little windy. Because I don't know, yesterday was a nice day, but when it gets windy like this, depending on the net location, sometimes it causes the net to roll, and that can be a little bit of a pain sometimes. Oops. Is everything waterproof there for you, Ethan?
This isn't, but
okay, because
a little splash is fine.
All right, I mean, there's not really anything I can do.
It's fine.
No, that's a little bit more than a little, and that wind's picking up now. It'll just once we go a little bit more. I mean, I wonder if I could go a little faster, maybe, and maybe that'll help, just to get us away from this. So something spawning wise, like there's a rock barn right here that you can see. It's that big rock on it. We'll go out to another complex in the mid lake as we go across, but there's some rock bars that are spread out over there too. You know, it's possible that there could be some spawning on those. They're just, we can't really fike net those areas. Yeah, so they're tougher to see, but there's at least a couple rock bars that are out in this area here. And through our radio telemetry, most of the walleyes live right in this bay.
Yeah.
There's a weed bed in about 9 feet of water where oftentimes we're out here doing our telemetry, that's where they'll be. And that's during the day too. I'm sure they distribute themselves around, but like we're on a rock, there's a rock bar right here. Yeah, we're on top of one. So I think some of the better trees Ethan will get are up here around the corner. I think what's interesting too is if you look from a distance here, does it look like there's anything different about the forest after 240 trees?
No.
It really was surprising me when we did this one too. It's like, it doesn't look different at all. Questions about it, or I want all the length, weight, and age data from bass ever collected in Wisconsin and we're doing analysis with. So I kind of call, the summers our construction or field season, and our winter is kind of our analysis, report writing, paper writing, scientific article writing, working on independent research, particularly for like our younger technicians that are just getting a start in the field and want to embrace that experience.
Fishing field work.
No, we've dabbled in a little bit. Like we've got radio transmitters, like you saw going to a tiger muskie yesterday. So we're tracking those fish year round on Escanaba. So we want to understand their winter behavior as well. So that's a little bit of winter work. We have done some of the fish sticks work in the winter time on some lakes as part of projects. We were going to get into some winter fisheries work by actually setting gill nets underneath the ice, but that project kind of fizzled out. The collaboration with Minnesota Duluth, it wasn't their fault or our fault. It just, there was some challenges with it and we never really got it off the ground.
How do you collect a pike net in the winter?
You basically drill a hole and you send out this kind of runner that goes along the ice and you got to intersect another hole to get the other end of it, and then that gill net hangs and you basically pull it out the hole. So, and you can pop in minnow traps and things like that too. So Ethan, you wanted to get maybe some GoPro or kind of stiller footage closer to the older stuff?
Yeah.
Are we going okay?
Perfect.
All right. The winner is kind of present. I call general fisheries ecology and management scientists that could handle just about any species. But we do have some specialization with Matt Mitro, with his focus on like statewide trout resources. And then Elb Psy is a kind of a quantitative stock assessment scientist. So he's more trained like almost like a marine fisheries person would be. And he handles a lot of our Great Lakes questions, where these are big models, big powerful models, complex models. And he's got a very special skill set.